Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 4th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you along, D.R. So, D.R., over the past week, we have been trying to figure out what to think about the executive order of the Trump administration, the executive order that basically tried to reverse all of President Obama's climate legacy, essentially tried to destroy the Clean Power Plan, to try to roll back the use of federal government tools like the social cost of carbon and the use of climate issues in environmental impact statements, blah, blah, blah. I guess instead of rehearsing all those details again, because people have probably seen those by now, what I wanted to touch on was the following thing, that President Obama's Clean Power Plan, good as it is, noble as it is, we all know is just a first step, right? That it's 30% carbon reduction from coal-powered power plants. Well, we know we need much more than that, and for long-term continuing reductions over the next 30 to 50 years. So I guess I saw some articles that said this is an opportunity. We should not let an opportunity go to a crisis go to waste. We should take advantage of the opportunity of Trump attacking the President Obama's Clean Power Plan by coming back and proposing an even bigger plan that's really needed. It's somewhat analogous to the calls for after the healthcare debacle that the Republican Congress put us all through a couple weeks ago. All of a sudden, the appeal of a single payer healthcare system is much stronger, and I hear more people talking about it. I think with Trump attacking these fundamental clean energy initiatives, it's an opportunity to come back and say, yes, we need to do much more than even those original plans. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and there was a great piece by Kate Aronoff in the Guardian to this effect that is basically saying that, you know, in addition to resisting Trump, we have to push for something more aggressive than just the Clean Power Plan. And as I read the piece, it reminded me of a controversy that we've discussed before regarding Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who, even though he has advocated for, you know, actions on climate, he's also, you know, greenlit a number of pipelines. And I think I noted before that at the time, the reason why he greenlit those pipelines is because he did not run on keeping fossil fuel in the ground, and there was apparently not a demand from the Canadian public to keep fossil fuel in the ground. What would happen, in fact, if there was a critical mass of voters who said, we don't just want reduction in carbon emissions, we want to keep fossil fuel in the ground. We demand, you know, more, you know, of a push for electric vehicles. We demand for more, you know, energy efficiency, and we demand no drilling, no fracking. I mean, for example, look at what's going on in Maryland, where you had a Republican governor bow to intense public pressure and say no more fracking in Maryland. Something like that is going to have to happen in order to sort of have the dramatic reductions and cuts in emissions that are required to avoid the worst. You know, politicians are not going to act unless there is a specific demand. What do I say all the time? Power concedes nothing without a demand. So the people have to insist that fossil fuel remain in the ground for there to be, you know, a radical reduction in emissions.
And I guess what echoes in my mind is the Tea Party kind of 2010 stuff, but also sort of the passionate intensity of the NRA people, the gun people, right? Mm-hmm. They are there all the time. And they don't really, I mean, I think climate hawks, you know, listen to reason and have more cogent and maybe more polite discussions. But the, the visceral intensity of those types of people makes things happen. And it seems like you're right, that somehow this is an opportunity to present that visceral demand that the planet be saved, and that we get it, and that our legislators actually hear that explicitly and are and know that they're going to be held to that, and not that they can just sort of check a box and say, I believe climate change is real. Oh, yeah, clean energy is nice. Check that box and move on. Right? We want them to really understand what they need to do.
So exactly. It goes back to the thing I've mentioned before, the Chris Hayes line about the asymmetry of intensity, where you have, you know, some people who recognize it's a problem, but they're not galvanized to have the problem addressed. And you have some people who think the problem's all made up and they're really, really galvanized to make sure that there are no solutions to what they regard as a fictional problem.
Right, right. Well, so I guess the that's great. I mean, I think that the idea that you we as climate hawks want to propose and insist on an enormous and inspiring program. Since Trump is attacking the existing program, the comeback is to propose something even bigger and better. It turns out that there was an article in Vox, which is V-O-X, Vox.com is a website. Explain the news, I think, is their tagline. But it was about, you know, a roadmap for how to achieve the right kind of carbon reductions. And in a nutshell, the plan, the roadmap says that between the year 2020 and 2030, the entire globe has to cut its carbon emissions by a factor of two, right? So a 50% reduction by the year 2030. And then between the year 2030 and 2040, another factor of two. Right, so now you're down to a quarter of the original, but I mean it's a factor of two in each decade, and then between the decade of 2040 to 2050, you need yet another factor of two reduction in the emission rate at that time. And of course that so that's put aside the fact that this roadmap, in order to succeed, also calls for, you know, 5 or 10% of the carbon dioxide being actually extracted from the atmosphere with some kind of technology that hasn't been invented yet. But the roadmap calls for us to reduce carbon emissions by a factor of two in each of the coming decades. And I guess the in order to do that, we need to start building now, because 2030 is going to be upon us in no time, right? So maybe in 20... But in the decade of the 2020s, there's low-hanging fruit, and we all decide we're going to drive electric cars, and, you know, we get half of the emission out of the way. By 2030, you're now getting into the harder and harder things to try and reverse, right? It's building efficiencies and where do people live and stuff like that. And we need to be laying the groundwork in the 2020s for reduction in the 2030s. And that is... There's all kinds of stuff underneath that as to how you would go about it. But that's kind of a roadmap. Did you see that article, DR? I mean, am I talking sense, or is it...
It was a great piece, and I thought to myself as I was reading it, although her name is not mentioned, this sort of, you know, calls to mind Naomi Klein's argument in This Changes Everything, in which, you know, she suggested that there's no way to have this level of decarbonization unless there's a dramatic international rethink of the concept of economic growth and how economic growth is defined. Because if we define economic growth as we traditionally do, you're going to see inevitably more consumption and thus more emissions. In order to sort of dramatically reduce emissions as much as possible, you literally have to, at the very least, rethink, you know, the way we do capitalism internationally.
Well, and that's a good point, because, you know, in addition to, so Trump's executive order calls for a big response. The big response is to say we're going to reduce our carbon emissions by a factor of two in each of the next coming decades. That sounds like a technical problem, that we need new, more and more and cheaper photovoltaic solar cells and all that kind of stuff. So it is a technical solution. But there's an article that I'll put up by a guy named Martin Boucher, I'm not sure, that basically points out that climate change is more than just a technical problem, that it's a social problem. It's how we view our consumption and our view our role on the planet, and how do we go about changing that view from which reduced carbon emissions would be a natural consequence, right? And as you say, the economics of capitalism have a huge pressure on making pollution, right, of all kinds, right? So the social innovation that goes into solving this problem is real. I mean, it could be farming techniques in the third world, right? It could be all kinds of things like that, in addition to, you know, a reduction in hyper-consumptive lifestyles in the first world, and the recognition that the bottom line of corporate existence is not the quarterly dividend, right? There are other things involved that a company should be doing. So it's just an interesting mix of ideas there as a roadmap of what we need to propose in order to get to the goal that we need to be at in 2050.
And sort of goes to the issue that we've discussed before, and that Sheldon Whitehouse has discussed before, as to why there is, you know, why companies that say, you know, they need we need action on climate change don't really get into the sort of, you know, brawl in Congress to sort of push for efforts to reduce emissions. You know, there is a difference between wanting curbs on emissions and dramatic reductions, because dramatic reductions inevitably, as Naomi Klein suggests, you know, calls for people thinking twice before they buy as much stuff as they do. And therefore, if people buy less stuff, then that obviously, you know, poses a threat to the bottom line.
Right. I mean, to your point, it's if you could magically change carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide molecule, into not being a global warming gas, right? Would the hyper-consumptive corporate machine still be destroying the planet? I guess, I mean, from a, I guess it, my hypothetical is a little screwed up there, I suppose. But it's the question is, what's the role of corporate greed in driving the destruction of the planet? Or human greed. It's not corporate greed. It's you know, what everybody wants.
It's like how you think of all the companies that rely upon palm oil, you know, and the deforestation that is involved in that. Remember that Harrison Ford segment from the first season of Years of Living Dangerously? You know, are people willing to are entities willing to give up the palm oil? Are people who like, you know, the materials that are made with palm oil, and if there cannot be an effective replacement for that, are they willing to give up those products?
Right. Or, you know, pay more for them from some other more sustainable. I mean, it's just like, I keep seeing this stuff that bothers me more and more now is the single-use plastic. Right? Mm-hmm. You see the animals eating them, the birds, you know, dying with their bellies full of plastic bags, and the fish in the ocean. I mean, that's not really a climate change. I mean, it's plastic fossil fuel use. But I mean, that's just a human insult to the rest of the planet to use those things and throw them away and think there's no consequence to it. Now, I don't know how, you know, I think that's part of the sort of social engineering of trying to address climate change, is recognizing things like single-use plastics are just bad for the planet. Or maybe reverse my own question. It's like, how do you solve the problem of climate change without having a fundamental change of heart about your relationship with the planet as a human being, right? And once you say, I'm in a different relationship to the planet, then fossil fuel stuff is just one of many ways that you might want to change how you live your life.
Exactly.
So anyway, let's just say that there is this whole, I think, more ennobling response to the Trump executive order than cursing his ignorance, right? There is a mechanism there, or a fulcrum at which you might want to be able to address the larger problem and regain the advantage. Having said that, let's go back and whine about some other stupid stuff that happened this past week. It's always fun to whine. In the exalted halls of the United States House of Representatives, the U.S. Congress. There's a guy named Lamar Smith who has defiled and embarrassed the organization by insisting that climate change is not real. And as the chairman of the House Science Committee, is trying to abuse actual climate scientists to embarrass them and intimidate them, right? Mm-hmm. So this past week, tell me, DR, what happened with Representative Lamar Smith? Remember that name? You'll see it on a prison outfit someday. But Lamar Smith, what did he do in Congress?
He held a bizarre hearing entitled Climate Science Assumptions, Policy Implications, and the Scientific Method. It went 2.5 hours. Three witnesses for the sort of the right wing side were Judy Curry, who you know, as much as she tries to deny it, she's disavowed the science. John Christie, another fellow who, as much as he tries to deny it, disavows the science. And Roger Pilkey, another one of these guys who does the Bjorn Lomborg thing of saying, yeah, it's real, but it's not going to be that big.
Right. No, don't worry. It's going to be great.
And for the actual science side, Michael Mann of Penn State, and Michael Mann, according to
Michael Mann is the guy who was responsible for the famous hockey stick graph. It was sort of this iconic part of the 1999 IPCC document, right? Mm-hmm. And that he then became a lightning rod because his name was on the paper, and every climate denier thought if they could disprove the hockey stick graph, then they would, climate change would go away. And of course, he was the evil monster of that, right? So this is who Michael Mann is, and he has done a lot of stuff since then, right?
Yes, and according to David Appel of the Clark Soup site, quote, Michael Mann is the Jake LaMotta of climate science. He goes in swinging and doesn't ever back down. He directly called out all three other panel members for mistakes, inconsistencies, and their insults, and he zinged committee chair Lamar Smith, too, unquote. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Roger Pilkey said at one point, quote, scientific uncertainty is not going to be eliminated on this topic before we must act, unquote. And he also later proposed having a carbon tax that would, the proceeds of which would be redirected for clean energy projects. And that
you're saying that Pilkey, who was invited in to be the kept scientist, the stooge to talk about climate denial by the committee, he turned around and bit the committee's hand and said that, oh, we really need a carbon tax? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And he got heat both inside and outside the chamber. Congressman Randy Weber, I believe, of Texas, referred to Pilkey's proposal as, quote, utter blasphemy, unquote. and Pilkey, from what I understand, he's taking a bit of heat online for daring to propose a carbon tax, although my understanding is that he's done that before. He's one of these guys. It's a position similar to, I believe, Arthur Laffer, the famous
Laffer, you know, curve guy,
exact right wing economist who's basically has said, you know, I don't know how significant this is, but just on the off chance that it is, let's have a carbon tax. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you know, Mr. Pilkey, you know, his cheerleaders have now apparently turned on him. He's going to now understand a little bit of some of the stuff that Michael Mann goes through on a daily basis.
Well, I guess, I mean, as everyone keeps saying in the age of Trump, I mean, the truth will finally come out, right? You can deny it and you can dance around it, but ultimately the truth cannot be destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. What's true is true. And maybe this is a circumstance where that finally pushes through. I don't know if Lamar Smith got it. I kind of doubt it. He seems to be... As I was telling someone today, the nun who taught me third grade said things like, there are no people so blind as people who will not see. Mm-hmm. And I think Lamar Smith is a guy who will not see the truth. And there you go.
But I'll say this, you know, Lamar Smith, much like Trump himself, is a living embodiment of the phrase that elections have consequences. You know, just think of if there's a changing of the guard in the House, Mr. Smith would become the ranking member, not the chairman of that committee.
Right. And so it would be that I will just close that by saying yes, which means you need to vote in the next election that's coming up and prepare yourself to do that well in advance. Well, DR, we got to put it down there. We'll tell everyone that they'll put out the. We'll put links to most of what we talked about in the blog that's associated with the podcast, and that will be at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook by at /massclimateaction. You can click through to the blog and the player there. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, and assorted other directories. And of course, you can find us on iTunes. So we'll close with where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.